Hello, this is Melissa, and it's Real History on Thursday, June 29, 2023. And I'm very happy to be joined today by Julie and JP of Book of Hours. And they were with me in April, and they're back again. And I entitled this one, I have the prerogative, it's my right to change the title if I like, but I put it up on the website today as Sadism. But we have a few things that we want to talk about. So hello, JP and Julie.
Hi.
Hello, Melissa. Thank you for having us back.
Oh, my pleasure.
Thank you.
How are you?
We're good. Just finally wrapped the new model Sadism last week or a couple of weeks ago, and it's starting to make the rounds. So I appreciate you giving us an opportunity to talk about that and why I wrote it and why I produced it. So it's definitely a heavy topic, and I think that a lot of people were shocked by it. Some people were really, they thought that, you know, it went into a completely different direction than, say, communitarianism went, which is a video essay that we talked about last time we spoke,
yes.
One that we produced a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. So I think we've gone to some pretty dark places. Just the powers that be mm-hmm. are finding some kind of sick pleasure in sort of torturing us and playing with our emotions, especially on the internet, especially on media. I noticed that people who don't have like a big social media presence seem to be sort of blissfully unaware of what's going on.
Well, I think, you know, to speak to like what you just said, like, you know, this is, we've gone to some dark places, but like this one is covering different territory. I think as, you know, things unfold since 2020, well, I mean, you know, we started in 2015, 2016, and we've seen things unfold over time, but like 2020 just hit us in the face like it did everybody else. And I think as things unfold, you know, and I've mentioned this before to other, in other places, other contexts, that it's like, you know, peeling the onion, right? And I think that our work has been doing the same thing. There's some things in our new model series that I'm not sure that I necessarily stand by anymore, but they're there. I can't change them. And I think that I can't stand by them because things have changed and I had no idea that they would change the way they did. And in other cases, we were spot on. So I think that, you know, we're fine there. But as things peel away and as we discover those things, I think that all of us have gone to darker and darker places. You know, going back to one of our first videos after the COVID scam, Quarantyrony? Yeah, mm-hmm. Quarantyrony. That one, like, after we produced it, it made me cry.
Mm-hmm.
And, but I don't feel that way as much anymore.
I think that one of the ways that you can always kind of gauge when you're being controlled or manipulated by narcissists or sadists or sociopaths is the very thing that you just said, which is that things change. They keep changing. So you go back to some of the things that we may have said in some of our previous video essays, and now we look where we are now and we say, well, that doesn't really apply anymore. And that is the nature of sadists. That's the nature of narcissists, is they keep changing the rules on you mm-hmm. and the expectations on you. So you think that you're getting ahead of it and, okay, I've got it. I've nailed it. I've figured this out. And then they throw a curveball in there, and then you have to go chasing down another rabbit hole. So, mm-hmm. so we always, and I think that's something that we talked about at the very, very beginning, before we even launched any of the video essays, we stood in a park, or we sat down on a log in a park, mm-hmm. and we talked about how the government had basically dropped us and that things are going to be chaotic now,
mm-hmm.
and that it's going to change from day to day, from week to week, and month to month, and year to year. This is sort of like your new normal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, every day is a new 9/11, it seems like.
Right.
You know?
And we called that video the reset.
We called it hard reset.
Yeah.
Before
mm-hmm.
anybody had even heard of Klaus Schwab and his book, COVID-19 and the Great Reset, or something
right.
like that.
Right.
So,
interesting.
You know, yeah. in general, in media and entertainment, you go back and watch things from 10 years ago and you hear the term reset dropped all over the place. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
There is an element. I just posted a short excerpt today called Psycholinguistics. And there's two things. This particular video didn't bring it in there, but there's psychic driving, which is, it's usually the repetition of an image, but it can certainly be language. And then psycholinguistics is just, it's the use of language to play with your head or control the way you view things. So, and there's been a lot of that going on. And when you look back, when you see things, it's sort of like with 9/11, how a lot of people out there on social media were showing you that 9 and 11 together had been used over and over for literally a couple of decades before the event.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. I feel that that's...
Well, you know, especially in the, you know, the fact that it's also the emergency line, right? And they've been using that for a very long time.
911, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's so strange because then, you know, you start talking about these things and you start going back, you know, dozens of years or decades, and you think, am I just in some kind of simulation? Is this real life? What's happening? You know?
That might be why people, you know, love the metaphor, the imagery of the blue or red pill, right? That
right.
Going back to, you know, that,
the Matrix.
The Matrix, right?
Yeah.
And so that simulacrum, you know, and the simulation of that, you know, that the world in, with, you know, that's encapsulated in that movie, you know, it translates now, right?
Yeah. Well, it does. You make me think of something from your latest new model, the Sadism, and that was when you were talking about how you said in there in your script that coming into consciousness is inevitable. And so the system run by Sadists is designed in such a way to keep us from that, but that because of the inevitability, what happens is that people turn in to all kinds of self-destructive ways because they know what they know. In other words, you cannot keep that down. And to me, that is what the Matrix simulacrum is that we have the consciousness to know that our environment, even though we were born into it and raised up through it, it's not reality.
Right. Yes. And it's so weird because piggybacking on what you just said about how we know that we're coming into consciousness. So there's a scene that was taken from a connection of mine who filmed a guy losing his mind on a San Francisco street where he was throwing trash cans into traffic.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember that scene?
Giant, there's those big trash bins that have wheels on them. They're very heavy.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so what I was trying to demonstrate, and I don't know if this came across, but what I was really trying to demonstrate is it felt like he was lashing out against this thing that's going to try to make him not be or not be human. And so he was taking every last bit of humanity that he had, and he was just throwing a huge fit, like, you're not going to do this to me. So I don't know if that point was really taken by the audience. I just felt like it was such a powerful thing to witness, and I think we're all sort of lashing out in our own ways.
I think also watching that was just the pure expression of human emotion that everybody is not allowed to have anymore.
Seems like it. Especially in San Francisco.
Yeah, especially there because it feels so corporate in that city. And that corporate denying one's humanity, you know, they've replaced, you know, who you are with what you are. So, you know, I've talked about this before with identity. You know, they're embracing the whole idea of the identity politic or the, you know, anything like that, where it's like, it's more important that you're, you know, that you can fit into some sort of set of identities and instead of like, you know, who you are, right? So you can't be yourself, but you can fit into these, you know, predetermined slots you know, gay, bi, you know, Latino, black, you know, whatever the case may be, right?
Or even just your corporate, if you work in the corporate sector.
Right, but you get that intersectionality, right? Mm-hmm. That matters more than, like, you know, just being a person.
Right. So there was that humanity aspect to that video where he was really just demonstrating how he didn't want to conform.
Right. So that was raw power, raw rage.
Raw emotion.
Yeah. It was very punk. Yeah. But it was also I'm being glib. But it was, you know, watching that, I could, you know, seeing this guy lose his shit. And it's very cathartic, but at the same time, you know that he doesn't realize he went to a place that he didn't realize he was, right? He went to some place that is just primal and just, you know, visceral rage.
I'm wondering if, you know, and if we're just being conversational today, I'm wondering if the powers that be or the structures that are in place are goading us to go into that primal space so that they can punish us for going there.
I think so.
There's a couple of things. First of all, towards the end of your video essay, Sadism, you talk about CRISPR technology and the idea that this will be delivered to us as the savior from our own failings, our own emotions, our own humanity. So there's mm-hmm. that. But the other thing that I thought that this brought up for me, I'm always seem to be looking at the dialectic or trying to spot the dialectic, and your essay made me think about the victim versus the perpetrator. And what came into mind, and we don't have to talk about this too long because we're not authorized voices, but what came to my mind was Malone versus Bregan, Goliath, mm-hmm. Goliath versus David.
Mm-hmm.
But what I have seen in that is interesting in and of itself. And like I said, we don't need to talk about this too much. Those of you who are listening to this, you can just take what I said and go look it up and find out what's going on. But it's the dialectic there that I was never able to get on the side of mass formation.
Right.
And as much as I appreciate so much of what Dr. Peter Bregan has done, and I've actually spoken with his wife, and she's lovely, I can't embrace complete victimhood. I always have to go to the individual and what is the individual's role in this. And so to me, the man in San Francisco throwing around the garbage can and just completely losing it is a public display of shadow work, however awkward and clumsy it is.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
Because
I'm always talking about shadow work.
Yeah.
And how important it is. And for you to go there is really good. Thank you. I like that.
I speak from experience, and there's some places that I don't really go into or need to talk about that much. Therapy is interesting. Jung is interesting. You know, I know what Alan had a lot of good things to say about Jung, but he also would call he would break down the word therapist and call it the rapist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You got to be so careful who you let into your mind. But nonetheless, just in the, I think it was either in the Redux I posted Sunday or the one I'm going to post Sunday, because they all run together in my head. But Alan was talking about the fact that we must do what you did in this video essay. We have to look at the darkest. We have to see just exactly who these people are. And we also have to see our own participation. And that, seeing your own participation, it requires some kind of shadow work. It really requires that an individual understand that whatever the perpetrators can do to us, we are actually capable of.
Wow.
I think that there's, you know, we've talked about this before, where, you know, everybody's become a narcissist, and that, you know, there's sociopathy, whatever you want to pronounce that, in all of us too, right? And so yeah.
That's okay.
I think the opposite is true.
Right. You know, without getting into like gossiping or anything, I've seen it happen with really, really popular influencers who have gone through, you know, a really horrible situation in their personal life. But on social media, they've developed sociopathy, narcissism in order to cope. And so they pull in the energy and the supply from the users or from, you know, their audience in order to counteract the devastating experience that's happening in their mm-hmm. personal life. So when I see an influencer, I just kind of go there. Like I just, because I think that in this world, in this strange world that keeps changing, and there's all this chaos and all of this sadistic energy thrown at us, I think you have to kind of weave in and out of a little bit of narcissism and sociopathy yourself. I mean, it's a terrible thing. As long as you realize that you don't do it to hurt people, you do it because you're in survival mode.
Right. Well, that's something that, you know, Julie said to me and to some other people. It's you know, we now have to become a sociopath, or we have to become, I guess maybe not a psychopath, but the sociopath, in order to survive. Because, you know, you get things thrown at you, and it feels randomly, and sometimes it feels like it's done to you on purpose, or that you're being targeted. But I also think that that's just a general thing that's going on, and that we're all experiencing that to some degree, and that we have to think like the people that are perpetrating the things that are being done to us.
Right.
I think, JP, that is a really good way of expressing it, because on the one hand, we have to accept that we all have these capabilities, but on the other, the most important thing, we don't want to be sociopaths, but if we cannot, if we can't understand how they think, we are definitely going to be victims, no doubt about it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Right. So obviously we live our lives in the real world as, you know, in loving kindness, which is how we live.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I don't want people to mistake what I'm saying, or, you know, about this and misinterpret it, which it could easily be misinterpreted.
We're not condoning meanness.
Right. We're not condoning being bad. You know, don't be bad.
Although being bad is so good.
Don't be bad.
But, well, yeah, see, there are a few things, and my thoughts were quite provoked in a good way by the video essay, because I'll just start off by saying that there's a warning label on it for nudity, and there is nudity, and so watch, I'll post a link to it, but watch with caution, or don't watch if you don't want to go there. I posted a little video that I made to go along with Alan's talk on Sunday, and when I got to what my choices are for putting it up on someone else's site, it was either for 16 and over, or it had a warning label on it. And I thought, well, if I had a 16-year-old, no, there's no nudity in there, but I don't like the way these people are dressed, and I don't like the language that's being used in a mainstream newspaper article. Yes, I'm going to put a warning label on it, and it underscores the point that I'm making, which is we have normalized perversion in the culture to the point where anything goes. And, mm-hmm. you know, so we... Okay. Before I lose my train of thought here, I also wanted to say, you take it back in the video to the founding of the country, and I think that that's very good. In other words, a sadistic mindset and how we were created, and the sadistic mindset goes into the annihilation or the extirpation of a group of people, in this case, the Native Americans of this country, in order that they could, you know, have their outpost here. Mm-hmm. But Alan would take it thousands of years back. He talked about the fact that in religions, all religions, and the military, you have an interweaving of an ancient brotherhood of deviants. This is a deviant priesthood. And this goes back thousands of years. And this deviant priesthood that kind of controls the secrets, what we might now call in our age social engineering, they've controlled this for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. So we actually are run and have been run by deviants for possibly many thousands of years.
Yeah, I'm not sure how to speak to that. I mean, I know, you know, we talk about something in a similar vein. And we, you know, we agree with what you're saying. We kind of frame it differently. But, I understand what you're saying about that, for sure.
Do you think that with this understanding of thousands of years of deviants disrupting sort of this, you know, disrupting the sacred, for lack of a better way of describing it, so we're aware of it. Do you think this is sort of like a new point in enlightenment? Are we starting to turn a corner? Is this an opportunity? Like, I'm just thinking that I don't know a lot of people that talk about this, and I don't know if it was spoken of 100 years ago, you know, or if anyone had the presence of mind to say this is thousands of years of deviance that's been weaved into our bloodlines, it seems like. And so now let's cut that. Let's step apart from that. Let's cut it off. You know, what do you think?
Well, I'll go back just to give one example of how old this is. Just think about the Aztecs, sun worship and human sacrifice to a sun god.
Mm-hmm.
This is such a horrific culture.
Mm-hmm.
It's really hard to wrap your mind around that.
Mm-hmm.
But bringing ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, so we've evolved beyond that. Like, we don't do that anymore.
Well, but we do.
We,
you know.
And it's, I guess, through pharmacia or, you know, through
even
pharmaceuticals.
Even through, you know, corporate culture.
I guess so.
You know.
So happy.
I think it just has I don't think that this deviant priesthood has evolved. They are what they are.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Whether go ahead.
Oh, I mean, I guess that's why I said corporate culture, because it's now, you know, human sacrifice is not, you know, having your head cut off or being thrown into a volcano or whatever their practice was, you know, having your life taken away from you via, I'm sorry, we can't have you working with us any longer. We feel that you'll be better suited in another opportunity. Thank you. Goodbye. And suddenly your income is cut off and you no longer are able to, you know, do the things that you did before. You had the job so that you could have the house, that you could have the car, so that you could get to the job, so that you could pay for the house, so that you could, you know what I'm saying, right? So that in and of itself is this sort of sadistic situation that has been put upon us, right? And then the sacrifice, the human sacrifice is you get that taken away from you. And, you know, people get upset that they're no longer in the corporate or in that job, right? And a lot of times it's as much about not belonging and being thrown out, you know, in how you feel, you know, that you're upset about the situation. It's almost as much about being thrown out and having that taken away from you, your work family or whatever, as much as losing that income, right? So it gets all tied up into basically your life has been taken away.
Yes. Because in this culture they've given us, that's our identity.
Right. Exactly.
Right.
So, you know, that's, I guess, maybe how I you know, when I said we frame it differently a little bit, I think that's getting into more, you know, like what we're talking about. In terms of like the ancient times, I don't know if we've talked about Gilgamesh before, but, you know.
Mm-hmm. We did.
Yeah. So yeah. We probably talked about that last time, so I won't go into it again. But I really feel like that is a very good story. It's a metaphor for, you know, the beginning of civilization, and along with the beginning of civilization, the idea of people who are rulers, who are above us, you know, kings and queens, and how they have this right to, you know, basically tell us what to do. You know, I think that a lot of that's a lot of what we're talking about started with that whole idea that we have these rulers that mm-hmm. that can, you know, set themselves apart from us and say that they're, you know, there because God told them, or, you know, basically deemed them the leader, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we were kind of joking about that the other day, Julie and I. You know, it goes back to that Monty Python riff, right? On life, on the Holy Grail, where it's like, you know, I didn't vote for you. You're a king. What's a king? I didn't vote for you. And he's like, you know, you don't vote for kings. Right. Right. So, yeah. So, you know, that's, I, you know, I agree with you. It's like, this is an old thing, but and it goes back a long ways, and it's, I think that the deviance comes out of that feeling of omnipotence, right? That mm-hmm. that feeling of like you are above others and mm-hmm. that you can get away with anything, and that, you know, what you say guides the culture. And so if they are saying, oh, well, you know, the gods have told us we need a human sacrifice, well, everybody get in line, right?
That's right.
You know, and to like even, you know, like the Spanish royalty, where, you know, well, they have a speech impediment, so everybody has a speech impediment.
Wow.
Right.
Well, you know, Julie, you asked the question, I don't remember how you phrased it, but are we coming into at this time a greater awareness? Are there more people who are conscious of what is going on? And I would like to think so, but it's difficult because, you see, you're talking again about this ancient system of control and mm-hmm. what they like to do. I mean, I was just flipping through Alan's Cutting Through volumes last night, and I was looking for something else, not this, but there was a line there when he said, we've always been given the exoteric form of a religion for the masses and the esoteric for those who create the religion, if you will. Mm. And so one of the things that you talked about at the beginning, you even said that you had changed what you were going to title the video essay, but you were talking about Christians whose response to this is, well, all of you who fell for this gene therapy and you're living through the fallout or whatever, you better get right with God. And they've got mm-hmm. all the Bible texts, and they can take this back to the book of Revelation, and they can point to all of the things that are happening. Well, I would posit that they are living in the exoteric form of their religion. So what is freely bandied about now is Satanism. And you had QAnon, and QAnon brought up. Now, the underground facilities where children are being held and their blood is being used and their adrenochrome, all of these things that come out around Q, or Pizzagate just morphed into Q.
Yeah.
So what you have there is something called Satanism. But what you have in the esoteric is you've got something that would be closer, more akin to Luciferianism, the light bearer. This is, if you want to call light knowledge, then you have a ruling elite who know that they have access to high sciences and knowledge which is kept completely hidden from us. And so they are in the know. They have the gnosis. They are the light bearer. They worship the light and they carry the light amongst themselves. We down here, the peasants, are in the dark.
I see. Is that where all of this is going? Because it's always bugged the crap out of me that people go to this idea of like Luciferianism and Satan and all this stuff, because, you know, as far as I'm concerned, and I'm going to insult a lot of people, I'm sure, but you know, Lucifer is a Greek myth that probably speaks to, you know, natural phenomenon, and, you know, and it's a way of describing something that is I mean, I've even heard that some of the, you know, I've heard somebody say, and this is just a quick diversion, somebody say that a lot of the Greek myths were and the stories were recipes for metallurgy of, you know, how to create bronze or how to create certain alloyed metals. But that's just a quick, you know, so that's what I'm trying to say is that these things are metaphors, and it goes back as at least as far as the Greeks and probably further, you know, back than that. And that these were stories as opposed to, you know, what I get really, my hackles go up when people start thinking of Satan as like a, you know, an actual being. And Luciferianism is this sort of like practice that, you know, some evil dudes in robes somewhere are, you know, are stirring a pot or whatever the, you know, the visual images that come up in people's minds. So when you describe it like that to me, that, you know, that these are people who are, you know, withholding the light from the rest of us, I understand that a little bit more, and it makes more sense to me.
Alan would make the distinction that they are two very, very different things, that Lucifer is very often conflated with Satan, but
right.
They come from different mythologies, different...
Correct.
Alan had a very delicate way of addressing these issues because he also understood a very powerful and important role. He understood that man is inherently religious. We have a need for a connection to something beyond us or higher than us or bigger than us that seems to be hardwired into us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the role, the function that religions have provided is to keep social cohesion going. And this is very good, but one also has to be conscious of the priesthood who are behind them.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that they are shaped for us. And someone that I was speaking to on Real History last week mentioned an organization called Doxideo. And he was just warning people. He said, I understand the inclination, the need at this time to have something that sustains faith in humanity, you know, your faith. But these organizations have been co-opted for Agenda 2030 and sustainability. They are all mm-hmm. used by the UN.
Sure.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
So, you know, well, I never really finished with Julie's thing, but
okay.
I don't know. I don't know that people are because this, it's so easy. It's so pat. It's so simplistic to say, get right with God.
Right. that's basically how we feel too. I mean, I do anyway.
Yeah.
As you were talking, I thought of that old joke. You know, my karma ran over my dogma.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like it's sort of the opposite of what we're talking about. But you know, whereas like, you know, the dogma gets in the way, right? Of the of what, you know, really is what you know, at the heart of you know, our spirituality.
I also think that. As you mentioned, Melissa, the powers that be or the people that are, you know, in charge are the organizations in charge. They are planning things out years and years and years in the future.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just to bring it back down to something very salient, the fourth grader across the street from where we live is learning to code for AI. On his summer break.
Or at least coding, but we know that will become, you know, coding for something in the future.
So I think that they're looking at that fourth grader as the potential person to code the AI, the robots, to make us irrelevant, to make human beings irrelevant. They're looking at the long game. So they mm-hmm. have that light, you know, that you were mm-hmm. talking about. Like they've got all sorts of information and access to technology and the potential for technology. And we're trying to I feel like all of us are, we've got our little pickaxes and we're just chipping away, and maybe we'll get like a little beam of light that comes out, you know, that tells us what's going on. But they're on the other side living in all of this information. They're mapping out strategies. They're thinking 20, 30, 40, 100 years in advance, you know, so down the road. So they've got a long game going on. You know?
Well, Alan would sometimes say, the Book of Revelation, are we looking at prophecy or a long-term business plan?
Right?
That's awesome.
Exactly. And I think I've said, you know, many times too, I think we're currently in the Book of Revelations. You know, we're living through it right now. So many people, especially the influencers out there, say we have to prepare for this, you know, this bomb to go off or something, and it's going to be like the Book of Revelations. It's like, no, we're living in it now. Mm-hmm. And the more benign it is, the more real it is.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Julie, what you said with the pickaxes, it reminded me of that Leonard Cohen song where he says, there's a crack in everything. There's a crack in everything. That's mm-hmm. how the light gets in.
Right.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah. Love it.
Thank you so much, friends. We're so privileged to be able to gather in moments like this when so much of the world is plunged in darkness and chaos. So, ring the bells that still can ring. Forget your perfect offering. There is a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. Every heart to love will come, but like a refugee. The bell that still can ring. Forget your perfect offering. There is a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in.
You know, and so, but at the same time, okay, at the same time all this is going, because people have this natural sense of resistance, right, to what's being pushed on them. You know, we are all basically, and for, you know, centuries, right, we have been people that are just like, we just want to get along with our lives. We don't care about controlling others. We just want to, you know.
Right.
Live our lives with our community, and
well,
you know,
it's because we don't look at human beings as a source of energy,
correct.
And a source of
right.
We don't look at human beings as a product,
right.
The way they look at us as a product.
Exactly. Yeah. But I guess the thing I was going to get at is that through all this, since 2020, I've been hearing a lot more physicians that are against all this crap. Start talking about biology and physiology, but even deeper than that, and saying, you know, we are electric beings. There are parts of us, you know, chromosomes and other aspects of our biology that are literally antennae. They're antennae.
Mm-hmm.
And that we are capable of things that we aren't even aware of. And I think that we once were aware of how to use these things. And that's where magic comes from. That magic
yes.
is something that was, it was always with us, but now it's become an abstract idea. And because it is something that we're capable of, and I don't mean like, you know, ooh, you know, come up with spells and all that
stuff.
No, I mean, but like real magic, like, you know,
right.
communicating with each other without speaking. You know, we have that now
right.
to some degree.
Right.
It's just not as well developed. I think the people were more capable of that before, and because of that, you know, that has been stamped out of us. It has been bred out of us to think that we have that capability. And that's why, and that is why magic is so, is considered, false and crazy and forbidden, and it's, and, it's looked on as something that is evil, right? And I don't think so. I think that it's what makes us who we are. And we have been, we have had that sense taken away from us over millennia.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I have this, I need to say, I have reverence and awe for something that I don't have words for, and experiences that I've had that I know are magical, for lack of a better word, mystical, maybe another way of putting it. But I have reverence for that. And sometimes I might call it creator. Sometimes I might call it intelligence. But there is something that we swim in that we're actually supposed to be supported by, that is to be all around us, lifting us up, pushing us forward. And that is the crime of this, what I'll call the ancient, what Alan called the ancient priesthood. This is the greatest crime against humanity, is that it is real and we're not supposed to access it.
Right.
Right. Yes. Right. So I think the technology, everything from your cell phone to any technology that might be in an injection, and even the social, behavioral control and the, and behavioral modification programs that are inserted into the curriculum for the school kids, all of that is, you know, meant to separate us from what you just said, where we have the capability of reaching new levels, where we can really communicate without saying a word. And there's a lot of power in that, and they're definitely they.
So you're the they.
They are really afraid of that power, you know?
Yeah.
They're afraid of that potential and that power. So,
yes, I am, I always will be optimistic and hopeful for the individual, because my own experience of even being able to verbalize any of this, just to cut to the chase, has a bit to do with shadow work, for lack of a better way of putting it. Facing yourself, getting through it, going, ah, okay, I see.
Right, exactly. And a lot of people, you know, live in, they suffer over their suffering. That's actually something that JP taught me when I first met him. Not that I was suffering over my suffering, but when I would ask him questions about individuals that he was connected to in the past, that was the way he would describe them, and I'd never heard anybody described that way. So, you know, I started seeing people who did that, and that really just, it really does impede growth. It takes away so much potential.
You know, you get trapped in your own cycle of emotions to where it's hard to get out of that.
Yeah.
And I'm basically talking a guy through some issues right now on chat, on text.
A
friend. We used to work together, and you know, he's going through something right now and beating himself up over his choices, and I'm just trying to help him get past that feeling and understand that it's okay.
It's part of a process.
It's part of a process.
Making the mistakes is part of the process.
Absolutely, right? Yeah. And to take the time that he has to enjoy things, you know, outside of this whole process of going through what he's going. I said something that I was like, wow, did I just say that in text? And that was, you know, and you know, take the time to go out and enjoy yourself. You don't get that time back.
Yeah, you don't. That's probably your 60-year-old self.
That's my 60-year-old self talking
to, going through that whole thing.
To a 40-something.
To a 40-something.
Right. Yeah.
Well, if we cannot impart wisdom with our gray hairs, what good are we?
I earned them, damn it.
That's right.
So, yeah.
Well, I wanted to see what JP is up to, but if there's more to say about sadism, I'd love to hear it.
Well, the only thing that I can say is I would hope that it would help people see more about it. Like, I don't want to, I feel bad because I don't want people to start looking at everybody like they're a bunch of sadists. Like, oh, are my parents sadists? Or is my boss a sadist? Or, I don't want that. I just want people to recognize that what it is, which is that they take extreme pleasure and delight in torturing people. And so once you can diagnose it and see that someone is taking pleasure in hurting you, then you can just step away from them. And also, once you step away from them, you'll see, there will be such a radical shift mm-hmm. in your experiences in life that a little bit of magic will actually open up.
Mm-hmm. Well, we joke with each other all the time. We take a line from The Simpsons. I'm going to stand over there now. But I think also this also humor also informed this essay too. Because for a long time there, Julie was saying, it's sadism, not Satanism, right? And so,
right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so.
Because, you know, well, we were both kind of getting tired of hearing that language. And we, you know, humor is a big part of our relationship. And I think, you know, you were even joking with your audience on your morning broadcast, whatever. And audios, let's say that. And it kind of came out of that germ of thought really drove this video essay.
Yeah, it did. So I guess the takeaway would be recognize it for what it is. Because I think the thing that was frustrating me was watching so many people go around in circles. Why is this happening? What is going on? I don't understand. People are dying. People are being mistreated, all this stuff. I don't, you know, and it's like, well, it's because you're at the mercy of sadists. They're having a lot of fun with you.
Mm-hmm.
That's why.
Is that why you put cats in the video?
That was so brilliant. I just loved it.
Yeah. Well, the piece before the cat scene was the cats, you know, scene. The multiple cat scenes was pretty heavy, and I thought, man, I better lighten this up a little bit.
Yeah, some comic relief.
Yeah.
Well, I just kept wondering where were the cat wranglers? Who were the cat trainers? That was just too great. It was too brilliant.
I know. Well, we'd been seeing those photos all through the whole COVID thing, and you know, they put the circles on the ground, and it's like, yeah, cats will go sit in something like that. They'll just, you know, anytime there's a space that's designated.
If they fit, they sit.
That's right. I mean, I do stretching every morning, and I put my yoga mat out on the floor. Like, my cat will go from the other side, will come from the other side of the room and sit right in the middle of it. Mm-hmm. It's a designated space, you know? So.
Yeah, yeah.
Well,
really interesting way they think.
It is fascinating. Funny. Cats are amazing. They have quite an interesting intellect.
Yes.
They do, yeah. And I often watch them, and we have a lot of alley cats around here, and I watch them, and I give them food and water. But, you know, not so close as to, like, say, hey, come here to my porch and, you know, you can join my family. No, we're not doing that. But we are giving them water, especially in the summertime. You know, and I watch them and their interactions and they are very interesting creatures. And we did adopt an alley. Well, she adopted us, mm-hmm. which is the way of the cat.
Yes, that is the way of the cat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, we could talk about JP's next project, if you want.
Yes, yeah, I'd love to hear about that.
Have we said everything there is to be said about
sadism? Okay. Yes, all right. I think so.
Okay.
And we went into spaces that were really quite interesting. So
yeah.
That's
good. Yeah.
Yeah. And I, there was one other thing that I wanted to say for your caution. You said you don't want people going around saying everyone is a sadist, but you have to see what is. And this is going to mm-hmm. be kind of, this is going to be dark, what I am about to say. Mm-hmm. But I hadn't thought about it in years, but yes, I was one who had to choose my weapon, so to speak. I had to choose the punishment. And our family had to choose the punishment.
Yeah, well,
and
so did
you know,
you, Julie.
I've known that about my father. I've known that about my parents. And like you said jokingly about The Simpsons, I'm just going to stand over here now. I did that years ago, you know, years ago. And I've made peace, and that's that. But you cannot, you can't get on with your life until you acknowledge what is. And, you know, I loved my dad. He held my hand when he passed away last year, and he had many, many fine qualities, and I never thought that I was unique to have had that experience as a child. It didn't shatter me. Mm-mm. To be punished in such a way. And looking back on it now, what I realize is he was a product. His father was a product. His father before him was a product. Everybody copes the best way they can in a world in which we're in the dark and other people have access to the light.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah. I think you're right.
Yeah.
That said, I mean, I made a choice not to have children partly because of just, I intuited my family's just, you know, the issues that have been going on in my family history for, you know, generations. And I don't know exactly what they are, but I know there was some serious narcissism, you know, in my grandmother's generation. Mm-hmm. And from both parents of my mom's, you know, both my mom's parents. And, you know, it affected the way that I was brought up. You know?
I think that, mm-hmm. Well, we're in that weird, I know some people don't like to compare generations, but I honestly think that Generation X made either a conscious decision or at least a subconscious decision to not procreate mm-hmm. simply because of the generation that raised us up or reared us up. It was just like, are you kidding me? So there was a lot of rebellion in Generation X, and I think it was a coping mechanism.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That and the propaganda that came hard and fast, you know, that the world's population was you know, growing and getting too large, and we shouldn't be, you know, all that. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
But I think that what you just said about, you know, you're just the fact that you have difficulty with your own parents mm-hmm. and that sort of informed the decision about whether you would ever be a father mm-hmm. is like, I think millions of people out there could mm-hmm. totally relate to that.
Yeah, totally.
It's not like you're
mm-hmm. I'm not unique.
Right.
It's no, not at all.
Well, you are unique, but maybe not in that way.
Well, yeah, okay. Yeah, exactly. Okay. I mean, I think that you know, well, let's put it this way. Most of my friends, you know, that we, you know, that we, Julie and I both knew, it was rare for those
anyone
to have kids. Yeah.
I'm thinking of all the people I know on a social level who are either 10 years younger than me or 10 years older than me. So that would be anywhere from 40 to 60. And mm-hmm. maybe one of them has kids. Like, that's a lot of people. The people we knew in San Francisco, people I knew in Chicago when I lived there, people I know here in Pittsburgh. It's very rare to meet anybody with kids.
Mm-hmm.
I've had this conversation with myself before, because my father was one of six and my mother was one of five, and all of their siblings, they all had many children. And then I look at my generation, all of my cousins, both on my mother's side and my father's side, and it just trickles down to nothing. I mean, it's astonishing to see, but it is a fact.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think, you know, I know that we're kind of getting off into different territory, but I really think that it has a lot to do with the economy. Feels like the previous generation could make a certain amount of money and afford to, you know, have children, afford to put them through school, afford mm-hmm. a house and car and a well-rounded, comfortable and healthy life, and that your employer, maybe in the 40s, 50s, or maybe even the 60s, or the 70s.
Yeah, even into the 70s.
Employer was like aware of that, and so would make sure that you could have a comfortable life. Mm-hmm. Here, you're just a wage slave. This is the gig economy. You work 3 months here and you're 3 months off, and there's no stability. Everyone I know is a renter. You know, mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? So this is what really frustrates me about the older generation, when they don't look at the past and how, I don't want to say how easy they had it, but how there were systems in place to make it so that a family could mm-hmm. be had mm-hmm. and that it was just an assumption that you would have children. All of those systems were put into place to make that easier, and those systems are gone now.
Like, no, this yeah. is, yeah, it's economic it's warfare, and what yeah. happened, you know, this period between, in the United States, between the end of World War II and into the 70s, was a period of prosperity. And mm-hmm. there may be people that hear this who go, well, it wasn't like that for me. But, you know, my parents didn't have money, but they could raise 4 children. They built their own home. They did all these things that I couldn't do. You know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
You know,
I exactly. mean, it's
my grandparents were working class people, and they had an amazing retirement. They were mm-hmm. able to retire at the, you know, the age that, you know, was
you
expected.
Should retire.
Right. They were able to live a life many years after they retired in comfort and they had a good life. I mean, they weren't living, you know, in a castle, right? But they were living the life that they wanted. Mm-hmm. And I think that's more important than having a lot of wealth.
Right. So you could be somebody that was working class or making just above minimum wage at one point and still have children. You can't do that now.
No.
I mean,
you just can't.
I mean, people do it, but they're also on Section 8 housing or whatever.
Right.
You know.
You need the system or the support network in order to help keep you afloat if you are making just above minimum wage and then suddenly find yourself, you know, pregnant or expecting, or your family is expanding, then you have to go to the state. And it used to be that you didn't have to.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So,
right.
Yeah, this is that kind of conversation that I feel like I've been having since I was, you know, 20. And most of the people in the baby boom generation get really, really prickly, as if I'm talking directly to them. And I'm like, I'm not talking to you. I'm looking at an overall, you know, overall, if you just take it as a wide percentage of the United States, people in that generation could do very little and have very little and still be able to live comfortably without having to rely on the state.
No, it's not it's not an attack on them, because they were living the life that was given to them to live, and now we are living the life that has been given to us, and it's increasing austerity, which is mm-hmm. poverty.
Exactly.
Poverty.
Correct. Yeah.
Poverty.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Poverty is made, you know, it's a creation.
Yeah.
But yeah, so thank you for indulging that
yes.
conversation.
Well, let's talk a little bit about AI.
Okay.
Oh,
artificial intelligence. So there's been a lot of hype about AI lately, especially with the release of ChatGPT at the beginning of the year. So, you know, we've been doing this series now for 3 years called the New Model Series, and we dropped it for a little while focusing on other things. But the tagline in every one of those videos, including Sadism, is this is the fourth industrial revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that is something that gets bandied about a lot, but what it really, really, really comes down to is artificial intelligence is the fourth industrial revolution. You don't have a fourth industrial revolution without artificial intelligence. It is what the fourth industrial revolution is all about. I'll stop trying to not say that so often. So the 4IR is what, you know, AI is that. So what is AI? So artificial intelligence, for those of you who you know, have a rough idea of what it is, I mean, it's basically computer software that has a lot of knowledge that it's gained through what they call machine learning. And that has basically been appropriated from all of us through our social media networking accounts, as well as, you know, everything else in the world. So, you know, Google publishing books for free, you know, the world's knowledge basically got digitized, and that was fed into machine learning, as well as, you know, politics and pop culture and everything else gets fed into the machine learning. And it's put into a form now that can be executed in a way that automates a lot of things that we could not automate before. And the interesting thing about it is when somebody interacts with something like, you know, with a generative AI tool like ChatGPT, it feels like you are conversing with it. It feels like it's thinking, but it's not. It's just regurgitating. Okay. And it's regurgitating and putting things together based on a prompt that you have given it. You know, find this, that, and the other thing, generate an essay about such and such a thing with, you know, a given perspective. And it will do that because, you know, again, it has the world's knowledge in that database that it can access, and the artificial intelligence is basically the software and the coding that has been created so that the computer can put all these things together and spit it out in just moments. You know, and I think that there's more to it than that I can get into as we talk, but I think that's it in a nutshell.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's a good overview.
And so JP just finished a 10-page script for that. He wrote the script. So I wrote the script for the new model sadism, and then the one before that, the new constitution living war crimes. Mm-hmm. But this script on AI is 100% written by JP. He works as a user experience designer. Mm-hmm. And an information architect. So he's informing systems already, and he's been doing it for 25 years. So all of your interaction on your apps and things like that come from a designer.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Who puts the tools in place sort of on the back end, and then the engineers make it go.
Right.
So he has kind of a unique, because of his background, he's more informed, I think, than most people. And, you know, again, I'm going to go into those spaces. I get really critical of people who are not in the industry. They don't understand about technology, and they go on and on and on and on about the evils of AI and stuff. And yeah, I mean, it's going to be evil because it's going to take away jobs for sure. And that's awful because, again, it will lead to austerity like we were just talking about. But the technology itself, I don't think, is something to be afraid of.
No, in fact, it's, you know, I'm a little, what's the word, when you don't really have an opinion one way or the other.
Ambivalent.
Well, not ambivalent, but like it's
neutral.
More of like a religious neutral.
You're
there's
neutral,
a
when yeah.
you're well when you're religion or when you're not necessarily religious.
You're agnostic.
Thank you. That's the word I'm looking for. Yeah, that happens now and then. Anyway, because on one hand, I can really see—I've been seeing the types of tools that are being rolled out in my particular field, and it's going to basically take away a lot of the drudgery of what I do, which is, you know, trying to come up with pixel-perfect screen designs that describe, how, a given app or web application might work. It takes that away and allows me to do the things that I do best, which is, bigger thinking, bigger picture thinking, and thinking about it as a system overall rather than worrying about, the pixel placement of a button, right? I don't care about that. I really don't. and the thing that's led to this is they call them, design systems. And so, corporate design companies and corporations all over have been coming up with they call them design systems. And, like Google has one. They call it Material. You can look up Material UI, and you can see that. And that's just basically, all buttons look like this. And if you want to express a go button, it looks like this. If you want to express a stop button, it looks like this. That kind of thing, right? We use these fonts, and this is the spacing, and that's all. So that's a design system, and so you don't have to think about that stuff anymore. You don't have to worry about if it's red. So what I'm getting to is like we have had design systems in place for the last 10 years so that you don't necessarily have to worry about, do I make it blue or do I make it green? What font do I use? And is the client going to go against? No, we have these design systems in place so that we can just go and just start setting things up and worry about the interaction, worry about how the system works rather than what font we're going to use.
Got it.
Okay. So those design systems are now being applied to the AI. And so something we call it generative artificial intelligence, generative AI. It's also being called large language models. And so ChatGPT is considered a large language model. And by that, I mean, like what I was saying before, it has sort of like the world's knowledge base, kind of packed into those servers that allows it to spit out that content that, you've requested it to do and put it together in that way. And something that I've noticed in my research and just in general, I just attended a conference, a virtual conference. It was an actual conference that took place. But since it was in San Francisco and I'm in Pittsburgh, I attended it online, and it was interesting. It's a tool called Figma, and they recently made headlines because Adobe Corporation is looking to purchase them, and they're still in negotiations, so it hasn't happened yet. So that's maybe where listeners may have heard that name before. And they basically build a tool that I, as a user experience designer, use to put my designs together in, right? And it's a collaborative tool. And they acquired a company that was building what they were calling plugins for this tool that were artificial intelligence, AI driven, okay? And so they started showing us some of the things that they're going to incorporate into this tool called Figma that, again, coming back to the idea that it will take away the drudgery. Now, something I noticed was they kept emphasizing, no, this won't take your job away. No, it'll be better than it was before. And I'm thinking to myself, what's going to happen is that it's going to be harder for people to get into my industry in the future without some experience and knowledge. So they'll either need to have experience doing what I do for a while so that they understand the underpinnings of what it is, or they really have to be savvy with prompting and understanding how to get what they need out of the large language model. Okay. Then I've been hearing a lot that same kind of like the opposite of that coming from the media, like it's coming for your job, but it's not really because it's going to, so you get this, again, and it's this, It's hyper-normalization, right, in the form of propaganda about people's jobs and the hair-on-fire kind of language that you'll see coming out of, the New York Times or other places. Then you'll have these pundits that come out, we listen to the All In podcast.
Yeah. I don't know if you're familiar with them.
No, I'm not.
Yeah.
They're venture capitalists out of Silicon Valley. One of them is one of the original founders of Facebook.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
So,
and then another one is currently involved with Twitter, and they are the investor class, and
they're the bad guys.
Yeah, we don't like them, but we listen to them for intel, right?
Yeah,
we get intel. And, you know, they were going on and on about these tools, about how great it will be for creative people because it'll allow them to do these fantastic things. And my position on that is that basically you cannot get fantastic art or creative work. You will get the pre-prescribed content that has always been around, right? Because we're the owners of the machines that run this stuff are going to be, you know, corporations and intellectual property owners, right? That won't want you to, you know, deviate too far from any given set of narratives or any given type of visual design or art. It will always be the least common denominator, most popular kind of looking kind of stuff, or, you know, scripts or stories or whatever. And what we're going to see are probably mashups of things. We just saw a group of a collection of movie trailers that were parodies
of AI. Yeah,
parodies of movies. So they were all these like movies that exist already, like Harry Potter and the Matrix, like we were talking about earlier, all directed by Wes Anderson. And that's really funny. They're really great. But that in and of itself is a good example of what we're probably going to get.
Right.
You know, is mm-hmm. is this so, sort of like mix, you know, mix up and mash up of, you know, other things all put together. And that's really not creativity. That's just kind of, you know, putting different ideas together and you know, coming up with something new.
I guess, yeah. I think politically too, artificial intelligence, AI, is really kind of a hot button issue. In March of 2023, the Biden administration deployed the Defense Production Act for the creation of these technologies and these chips that are needed for AI. So I've been following that the deployment of the DPA in March of 2023, you know, this whole time, and I'm like, okay, so when you deploy the DPA, it means you're at war. So
more or less.
What the heck? That's kind of weird that he would put all this money into AI under the banner of the Defense Production Act. And the company that got like the bulk of the funding that was deployed was a company called NVIDIA. And mm-hmm. they fuel AI, so you're familiar. And mm-hmm. James Jensen Huang is the president and CEO of NVIDIA, and he's been really working it. He's been on stage a lot. He's been sweating bullets trying to get people to come on board and, you know, further fund NVIDIA. But just today, I noticed that there was, you know, an article from CNBC, their tech area, not just like a main CNBC article, but their, you know, their technical area, that the political, you know, theater is starting to bubble up when it comes to AI. They're worried about China getting a hold of, you know, mm-hmm. getting a hold of the information. So my feeling regarding, you know, everything that JP said is that it's definitely coming, but it's probably going to come in fits and starts.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Like, it's not going to come smoothly because of this political football that might be going on in the background.
Right, and I talk about a little bit about the NVIDIA thing, and in terms of the, you know, the CHIPS Act, and then the DPA for the circuit board production and packaging, and all bringing it to the U.S. you know, manufacturing, and it's like they position it as if this is a good thing because we're bringing manufacturing back to the U.S. and it's not going to bring any more jobs.
No, what it's actually right. doing, what it is bringing to the United States, is propaganda and false. What I believe to be sort of false stories about some of our idols. Now, just before we started this conversation, the news had just dropped that Madonna was intubated and is in the ICU in New York. My feeling is that Madonna has been probably gone from us for a while, and any weird sort of crazy videos. Remember all those pictures and videos we were seeing of her where she looked kind of demonic and
she looked like she was trying to be 16.
And she was dressed really strangely, like she was trying to be 16. I do believe that that was AI. That was just a mash of imagery that somebody fed into the system, and that she's been gone from us for a while. And I see the same thing with Britney Spears right now. A lot of people are saying, what's going on with Britney Spears? She turned off all of her comments on her Instagram page, and she's doing these crazy dances. She doesn't even look like herself inside of her home. I think it's AI, and I think that Britney Spears is somewhere else. So when you talk about AI being, you know, not something that we really have to be afraid of, I think it's actually used for the most benign things, like propaganda.
Right.
You know, yeah. I think it's like pretending that this is really Madonna dressed like a 16-year-old anime girl or something.
Right. Well,
you know, this is not reality.
I get into that a little bit, and I talk about something that you brought up to me, and that is something to be concerned about, like if you believe in voting, which we don't, but at least not representative democracy, especially in its current form, that we will be, that AI will be able to, through AI, will be able to receive tailored content that is tailored to our particular point of view. And, you know, that we've already seen deep fakes coming out with, you know, Biden saying crazy shit, right? Beyond the crazy shit he usually says. But like, or Trump saying stuff. And these are like deep fakes. Well, I think that they can take that technology and push specific content to meet your own specific point of view, whether that's the candidate that you're for or against.
Right.
And that's very dangerous, I think.
Right. My response to many people, and I know that we're getting up, you know, on time here, but my response to many people when they do say things like Joe Biden is a bumbling idiot or a fool, and I was like, well, you know, he had the presence of mind to sign the Defense Production Act and put billions of dollars into AI. You know, is that really, you know? So I'm trying to inform people, while JP is going into the technical aspect of it because of his, you know, background and what he does for a living, he's got a keen insight into these things. But I'm also like applying it to things like the Defense Production Act and so much we're seeing, especially on Twitter and platforms. I think they're mostly AI, and I feel like a social anthropologist where I'm watching the screens and I'm going, this isn't real. You know, is the whole RFK Jr. going shirtless, is that even real? Like,
I know, we questioned that when we first saw it. We're like, do you really think that's real?
Well, so there are two things that you bring to my mind. The first, unfortunately, I can't bring it to my recall, but there was a kind of a low-budget sci-fi movie that we saw a few years ago where they had these, they were like spider bots that could see through walls and they could go in and, you know, I don't know what they were run by, but they were basically a kind of a bot. But what was at the heart of the story was that the president no longer existed. He was just a hologram, which is just a way of saying AI, right? He was a holographic projection, and all of his appearances, or a deep fake, whatever, you know, terminology, but at this time they use the word hologram. He did not exist. He was programmed to give speeches, and, you know, so this was a big, and the other thing that you made me think, and I don't know if I can find this, yes, here she is. She's a woman from the World Economic Forum. She works for Horizons Canada, which is a government office of basically the convergence of biology and digital technology. And her name is Christel van der Elst. And I won't be able to pull it up, but when I was researching her for something several weeks ago, I learned that in addition to working for the government of Canada, she is working for a U.S. government office, and one of the things that that office is tasked with is deep fakes. Uh-huh. So now, when mm-hmm. they put things yep. across to us, they always tell us, oh, right, well, we have to find out what the bad guys are doing, right?
Cause right, yeah.
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 Uh-huh. Who's watching the watchers?
Right.
Right.
Right. I got a bridge to sell you.
Yeah.
yeah, totally. And you know, we get into this thing called hypernormalization, right? Mm-hmm. Where you have two messages that are opposed to one another coming out of the same office or the same propaganda apparatus, right? And AI will be very good at that. And this the deep fake technology is going to be very good at that. And I think, you know, deep fakes have been around for a long time, and it's been pointed out that the technology has become so good that it can that it's almost in real time now. If you're watching a video, mm-hmm. you really can't trust that. And
yes, that's right.
You know, because deep fakes can go in real time, can work in real time. And this is just basically, you know, this was just algorithmic. This wasn't even artificial intelligence necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
And so now, you know, hypernormalization, what I say in the video is that, you know, AI will be hypernormalization on steroids, right? Because, you know, it will be able to, you know, through facial recognition technology, through all the marketing data they have in the world, all the other information they have on you, you know, things can be generated now that will feature your face or your likeness, rather, and or anybody's likeness, you know. And it's just the world is going to be, you know, again, that word that we were talking, that we brought up earlier, simulacra, right? It's going to be, mm-hmm. you know, nothing but, you know, deep fakes and imitations and the God, there's a word for it, hyperrealism. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Everything will be hyper-real.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And this is going to have a profound psych, in my opinion, not that I'm a, you know, an analyst or a psychologist, but I think it will have a profound psychological effect on human beings. They're, you know, living in their screens and living through this hyper-real AI world. And then once they venture outside, the real world might be a huge disappointment. You know, mm-hmm. I never dated online. I never, you know, met anyone from like the internet, because I knew that whatever image they had of me in their mind the real me would never live up to it, you mm-hmm. know, because I'm a real person with real flaws. And so that's the fundamental problem with AI, is that the real world just cannot live up to the features that AI can bring you. Some of the people that we were watching who were talking about the different AI programs were saying, you know, look at this. And he showed a picture, or he showed a video of a sort of a 20-something, you know, young woman in like a hoodie or a sweatshirt or something, saying, hey, look, Chris, it's been ages since you've been to the gym. We'd really like to see you come back and upgrade your membership or something like that. Mm-hmm. And it was totally AI, and it looked like a real person.
Right.
So,
wow.
Yeah.
You know,
there's this website out there, Be Human, and it's just the word, the letter capital B, and then human, and you can basically, you know, this is being set up for businesses to use for marketing, so that they could do exactly what Julia was just describing. You know, you can basically take your list of contacts that you have, and you can feed it into their database, and it can generate personalized videos that reach out to potential clients or existing clients to speak to them using your likeness or somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
So it's or somebody made up. This company actually engaged with some actors to do some facial recognition and some, you know, basic, you know, like voice recognition or whatever, to imitate their voice, to imitate their likeness, so that they could then have this person, this persona, fit into whatever marketing you would like them to send out.
Right. And I think Black Mirror's first episode of their latest season It's called... Joan is awful.
Joan is awful, right?
It's about AI, is what it is,
and deepfakes. Yeah,
and you know, and it goes into this extreme situation where you know someone unknowingly, just by having a Netflix account, unknowingly gave away their image and their likeness and their privacy, just gave it away, so that AI could be generated and TV shows could be made, and each of those individuals was then turned into something awful.
Mm-hmm.
And so it made the real world hate them, even though they weren't really like that, you know?
Yeah.
So
mm-hmm.
anyway, that's an extreme sort of, I mean, that's a show.
Yeah, right? I know it's a show, but it's a great story.
It was a great story.
Because it illustrates the dangers,
yeah.
right?
Yeah,
I heard that it's called, the name of it again, the episode?
The series is Black Mirror, and the particular episode is called Joan is Awful.
Joan is Awful.
Yeah.
Well, I heard this on the news, and this was mainstream maybe a week ago, and again, is it real or not? I don't know. But a woman was warning of something that she said happened to her. She received a phone call. It was her daughter in a panicked voice saying, "Mom, help me, I've been kidnapped." And then the phone was snatched away. On the other end, she heard the phone being taken away, and then the kidnapper got online and said, "This is what you're going to have to do, blah, 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 don't call the police, et cetera, et cetera." She was at a public event, and this went on for like a minute or so. She muted her phone and yelled for help and told people what was going on, and someone there said, "This is a hoax. You need to have one of us call your husband, find your daughter. This is not real."
Wow.
That's amazing.
Wow. Well, you know, stories like that are fielded out, whether it's a real story or
exactly.
not, fielded out to us to sort of
hyper-normalize,
mm-hmm. you know, yeah. tell us what's really going on, like,
but
like
also scare us.
And, mm-hmm. and scare us. And it's weird. It's like that story would then scare me away from my computer screen. It would scare mm-hmm. me away from AI
mm-hmm.
and adopting any kind of technology into my life. So is it counterintuitive? Like, is it counterproductive? I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So well, that's interesting.
When yeah. is this? When is your next installment of the new model coming out on AI?
Oh, probably not until August.
Yeah,
okay. we have some things going on in between now and then, and
huge okay. things.
okay.
And you know, like I said, it's, you know, we're working differently on this one than we have before, and that is that we're actually going to use the artificial intelligence technologies made available to the public. So these you know, large language models, these tools that are available, and you can generate video from a script, from just like describing something, right? And it'll mm-hmm. generate a video clip for you, whatever length it is. You can use still images, like
right.
a still image of a person or whatever, and you can have it, you know, have that face now animated and speaking the words in your text.
Right.
And so you know, we're going to use these tools that are, you know, out there and made available to the public to generate this video. We're going to do individual clips and string them together like we always do to, you know, sort of illustrate or not illustrate points.
Yeah, but what you're failing to mention is that we're learning them. We just started learning these tools. I mean, like with any technology, you've got to spend some time with it and make mistakes and figure out mm-hmm. how it works. I mean, you know, I'm still mm-hmm. I'm mm-hmm. still fumbling through Final Cut Pro, which feels like it's
yeah.
a dinosaur
right.
compared to AI.
Right.
So
yeah, because there's going to be AI tools for doing, you know, video production and effects and things like that.
So we have to learn the tools as well. So that takes time.
Yeah.
You know,
but it's still, you know, as magical and crazy as it all sounds, there is still a lot of tedium involved with it. One guy was describing on a video on YouTube how to generate a podcast using AI tools, and he had to go through all these various iterations of creating the content. So even though ChatGPT was generating the content for him, he had to make sure that he understood how to organize his thoughts, how to feed the information into ChatGPT in order for it to spit out the code or the content that he needed. Because each sort of dissemination of content that it will give you is around 4,000 characters. So he was saying, you know, I can't just say, you know, make a, you know, write a script for a podcast on this subject and then let it, you know, spit out the whole thing. He had to do it in segments, and he had to do it in a certain order, and he had to do, you know, and then he'd feed that into the next segment of what ChatGPT could spit out for him. So then finally, it took him, you know, maybe, you know, a half hour or more to get all that organized and put into place. Finally, he had a full script that he could then go to another tool that would then spit out the artificial voice using a fake name. And then, you know, he could take that, download it, and then upload it to, you know, like Spotify or any of these other podcast things. But it was interesting to watch him do that. I mean, he was able to condense the work all into, you know, a 5-minute, you know, YouTube video. But
it takes
a while to get there, just mm-hmm. like anything else. So, you know, the things that we do now with our video work are pretty amazing, but they take a long time, and people don't, I don't think people understand, you know, how long it really does take
to edit together
a video.
I have people say, oh, gee, I like your video essays. I think I'll do it too. And I'm
like, all right, have fun.
And you, Melissa, I mean, you make videos too, so you understand, you know, what's involved.
Well, you know? Yeah, not at the level that the two of you are working, but I.
Yeah. But I mean, you know,
it is impressive.
We're doing things that we couldn't do 10 years ago. We're doing things that people, that, you know, content producers could not do, you know, 20, 30 years ago. I remember when my brother told me about the type of video editing, nonlinear editing, and I forget the name of the application he was using, but this is 25 years ago, and I was like, wow, that sounds really cool, and he showed me some of the work that he was doing. And, you know, now that's just like how we edit video, right? This
right.
is how we make movies. That's how right. we do everything, right? Mm-hmm. And it's so much faster than, you know, a razor blade and film.
Right.
But but it's the same idea. It's just that it's faster. But it still takes a lot of work, a lot of effort and planning, and it's the same process that you have to go through, whether you're in an editing suite with a razor blade and film, or you're in an editing suite that's, you know, digital.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's still that, you know, so on that side of like, no, it's not going to take jobs away. You know, yeah, there's going to be that, but, you know, there's going to be... At the same time, though, you know, like one of the examples that was given was, you know, one experienced programmer can do the work of 10 or more junior programmers together, because if he knows or she knows how, you know, how to use the tool, they can generate code of a whole suite of coders. And, you know, just with one person and an AI tool. So,
right.
you know, so these things, you know, this is going to be, we're going to see how things are going to play out. But, you know, it's going to speed things up, but you're still going to know how, you're still going to need to know what you're doing in order to make that happen.
Right. I think we should plan now that you come back in August once you've released it and I can see mm-hmm. it, and we can talk about a little bit more about AI and deepfakes, because I think you both made some very thought-provoking points that the world that we are living in may have a lot more deepfakes going on than we're cognizant of.
I agree. I agree. Yeah. And some of them, you know, they're very, it's very obvious that it's an AI, you know, thing. Like we saw a video the other day, guy giving commentary, and he looked like a rock and roll DJ from the 70s. Very cool, very, you know, like he had the shades, he had the hair, but he was a guy that was probably in his, you know, late 50s, early 60s, you know, very rock and roll. But you could tell that, you know, it wasn't a real person. It was a character that was mm-hmm. created. Mm-hmm. And I think that was done on purpose. It wasn't intended to fake you out. But, you know, at the same time, it was like, wow, this is kind of eerie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, it's kind
how,
of
how
it's
realistic kind of they can get.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly.
I think we'll talk again in August. And I know that you've got a lot going on in your lives right now. So I think the next time we speak might be intense.
Yeah.
Yeah. It might even be from a different location. Who knows?
Yeah. Well, I am looking forward to that. And I will say that I've really enjoyed having you both back on. It's so much fun to talk to you.
Thank you so much. We love talking to you as well. I learn stuff when I listen to you talk, and I really am honored. We're both very honored that you brought us back. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Melissa. Wow. We enjoy talking to you as well. It's a lot of fun.
Well, it's my pleasure, and to everyone who is listening to this, thank you again for listening, and I will be back next week, and I think I know who's coming next week, and it will be a good talk as well, so thank you.
Well, I've got some